Thank you for listening to an audio recording from the Midwest Genealogy Center's Tell Me a Story program, an initiative dedicated to preserving America's history through the timeless practice of oral storytelling. To learn more about the Tell Me a Story program, including how you can add your own story to the collection, visit MidwestGenealogyCenter.org/tellmeastory. On behalf of the Midwest Genealogy Center and Mid-Continent Public Library, we hope you enjoy the following story.
This is Jenny Tatman, and it is September 11th, 2017, at the Midwest Genealogy Center, and we are doing an oral history interview today with Larry Stevens. Hi, Larry, how are you doing?
How are you doing?
Great. you had some things you wanted to talk to us about today. Starting off, I did just want to talk to you a little bit about, you know, your military service. So you did serve in the military, is that correct?
Marine Corps.
Okay, in the Marine Corps. Is there anything else specific with your title we need to know about?
No, not really.
Okay.
I was in motor transport.
Okay.
And I was in motor transport right after boot camp and infantry training. Stayed in motor transport, sent to Vietnam. I was still in motor transport, but once I got to Vietnam, my duties expanded unbelievably just because motor transport did so many things.
And what year was that you started in the military?
I started in 1965.
Okay.
And a year later, September 1966, I was in Vietnam.
Okay.
I was part of, if you want to call it a surge to Vietnam.
Sorry, I'm taking notes too.
That's no problem.
So I don't forget.
You can call it motor T. Everybody understands what it is. Okay. They've been in the military at all.
Gotcha. And now you were saying there's some things specifically you had today that you wanted to talk about in relation to your service.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about PTSD.
Okay.
I've had PTSD now for decades since my service in Vietnam, and I was there from 1966 to 1967. And PTSD is just not understood at all. It's an invisible wall. Nobody can see it. They don't understand. What do you mean?
Right.
You know, that type of thing. But nobody really understands it. Yet PTSD actually goes back, but not called PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, mm-hmm. back to the Civil War.
Right.
The danger and the combat back then, soldiers came back. They were changed. And it went up through any other conflicts we were in, including another war, World War One, World War Two. Once I began to learn to look for signs, I found that many people came back from World War Two with PTSD, but nobody knew what it was and nobody knew how to treat it. And there just wasn't any help if you came back because you were changed.
And so you said, what was your, you know, experience with that?
With PTSD? Mm-hmm. You don't really know that your mind is changing, but your brain is rewired to address the danger and a threat to life. Okay? And there are two primary elements to PTSD. One is battle mind, the other is survivor brain. You're always ready for the battle, and by God, if it comes, you're going to survive. You and yours.
Right.
So that's how you're thinking, and it really colors the way you do things. Once PTSD is developed, it can't be cured. You'll never be cured. However, it can be managed if you understand what's going on with it. PTSD creates trajectories, and that's my term. That's not anybody else's term. It's mine.
Okay.
And they are habits, actions and attitudes based on battlefields, challenges, and stressors. You begin to see things as a battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these trajectories can be productive, they can be counterproductive, and the battlefields, challenges, and stressors can become so overwhelming that suicide becomes the only option. Believe it or not, there are Vietnam veterans now still committing suicide. So, and I wasn't aware of that until just within the last 6 months when I found that somebody had committed suicide. So it's very serious, and it's something that you have to recognize. Managing PTSD comes with a recognition that something is wrong and changes are necessary, even though you believe you're acting normal. But normal being that you still, your brain still thinks you're in war, and that there's danger and threats to life. Removing personal battlefields, which is where I've been at, can assist greatly in reducing the stressors. That helps everything else out. The war veteran with help can conduct a personal inventory into the trajectories that they've adopted, and they can recognize what needs to be changed. That's still a work in progress with me, trust me.
Okay. I gotcha.
Part of that is making good decisions. A critical element in managing PTSD with or without professional help is good decisions. Now, in a little bit, you'll find out how long it took me to get professional help, but I made good decisions.
Okay.
Number one, I married a wonderful woman, and along with that, I said, I'm going to make this marriage work. If anybody's got any problems in this marriage, it's going to be me, and I understand that. Second, when we started having children, I was going to raise them as best I could, and I wasn't going to pass along my Vietnam issues to them. In other words, PTSD. So, right there. And third, when I finally did get a PTSD evaluation in the VA, I admitted to something I didn't even think about, and it opened my eyes. Look, you've got to go get help. And once I got the rated disability, that put me in for, or that made cost-free services available to me in the VA. And I'll explain more on that later on.
Okay.
Again, going back to good decisions, a war veteran is more capable of making good decisions if they consider taking care of myself doesn't mean me first, it means me too.
Right. I like that.
Including your family.
Yes.
Considering your loved ones makes good decisions a whole lot easier. Much easier. Now, for PTSD intervention, President Obama adopted an Israeli model by embedding mental health professionals in some outfits, allowing for earlier interventions and interventions. In other words, they can recognize when somebody is moving toward a wrong place.
Okay.
And they can take actions then, or at least try and help them. And trust me, when I got back from Vietnam, I was spiraling.
Really?
Oh. The wife and I were married in 1974. If we had not gotten married, I wouldn't have been dead by 1977.
Wow.
Either by doing something extremely stupid, which I was prone to, or by my own hand. That's how bad it was.
I was going to ask, did you meet your wife before you went, you were in?
No, after.
After.
It was
okay.
After, yes.
Okay.
So, no, she's the one that saved my life.
Wow.
In fact, one of my boys, my youngest, at the age of soon to be 33, said to me one day, he said, Dad, I know you kept a lot of stuff from us, and we appreciate it.
Really?
Yeah. Now, what President Obama did was a... excellent first step. Unfortunately, the Israeli model also had was more comprehensive.
Okay.
They had support at home. They had support inside the military. That hasn't happened yet. And the size of trying to change that in the military is just unbelievable. I mean, it's just a huge task. But just getting people in there and trying to get intervention at the earliest possible time is the best way to go.
Sorry, I'm kind of writing questions as we
go. You go right ahead. You go right ahead. Just jump in anytime you want to ask a question.
And I guess I'll kind of let you continue. I have a few questions I might ask at the end, but I don't know if you're going to talk about it. There's a few you've been answering as I kind of make notes. So.
Well, go ahead and ask questions now.
I was just going to ask, it looks like you have done quite a bit of, you know, research on, you know, PTSD, what kind of help you can get.
Well, I'm in therapy now. I've been in therapy for, in fact, I've been in therapy for just a little bit more than 5.5 years.
Okay.
And that brings me to a timeline, and I think this is important.
That would be helpful.
I served in Vietnam in 1966 and 1967. I did not have my first cost-free, I want to repeat that, VA PTSD counseling session until January 2012.
Okay.
Do the math on that one.
Yeah, that was quite a few years later.
And the problem is that PTSD gets more deeply inset the longer it goes without intervention of some sort. During my service in Vietnam, I was exposed to Agent Orange.
Okay.
And that's dioxin. I had Agent Orange health issues while in Vietnam and had another Agent Orange related health issue requiring an operation before I was released from active duty. While I have cost the main other defoliants, there were other ones too. There was something like, I read 65, but I know that there were certain main ones. One was Agent White and one was Agent Blue, and Agent Blue contained arsenic.
Oh.
And the color agent they used depended on the plant that they wanted to defoliate.
Right.
The trouble is they sprayed it over everybody, and I've got another report that said if you were even at airports, you were exposed because of the planes. While I have cost-free services for my PTSD, I have no such services for my Agent Orange health issues unless I file a lengthy claim or pay for them.
Wow. So that's even on top of the other things you're dealing with.
And I'm 100% disabled, permanent, total, and I'm unemployable. And I can't get any other services than, you know, for my PTSD.
Right.
Now, some war veterans, caveat to that, will say their VA experience is better than a sliced bread and maybe even canned beer combined. But they have no idea how brutal the VA can be. I was with my caregiver, and I told her, I said, being in the VA is like being in Vietnam again.
Wow.
And I've been in the VA for 10 years now, which ought to tell you something right there. So go ahead. If you have questions, go for it.
So, you said it was, you know, you served in Vietnam until 67, and then you didn't start doing therapy for your PTSD until 2012. Did you go seek out, did you have to seek that on your own, or did somebody from the VA approach you, or how did that work?
I had to seek it from the VA.
Okay.
And they finally said that they would sit me, they gave me a PTSD evaluation. And it was during that evaluation that something came out I didn't even think about.
Okay.
So, and that's, boy, we got to get in there and get some help,
right,
you know, type of thing. Because I recognized there was something very seriously wrong. But it took me all those years to get cost-free services.
Right. Had you tried before 2012 to get those services? Or
I was in the VA I've been in the VA since 2007.
Okay.
They don't give you anything for free.
So it took you those years to.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's a whole story that goes beyond that, but right, we can, that would detract from where we're going here.
Okay. And is it, do you feel with your experiences, is it normal that, you know, most returning veterans, or do you know, does it usually take them a lengthy time when they get back to seek help, or is it,
they can't. They can't. If they're willing to pay for it, the VA will take them in a heartbeat.
Right.
And otherwise, you're on your own.
Okay.
So it's, VA is not a good place.
And the bad
thing,
that.
Well, the bad thing about the VA is they mess with the wrong guy.
Okay.
I've got 25 years at least investigative experience under my belt. I've even got the evidence.
Right. Looks like you do have quite a bit of research. For sure. That was so far. That was the questions I had
Okay.
written down about what you're talking about with the post-traumatic stress syndrome. Was there anything yeah. else you wanted to...
Just if anybody that? Thinks, if any war veteran, mm-hmm. someone who has served in war, if they think they have PTSD, you've got it. Mm-hmm. Go get evaluated.
Right.
And then the trouble is that they have linked service-connected disabilities to getting cost-free services. There's the problem with the VA.
Okay.
And a lot of people don't know that. And you can that creates a whole bunch of other problems.
Right. So, kind of to get out on a little bit of different track, were you also wanting to talk a little bit about your experiences in Vietnam? Is that something you're willing to talk about?
Yeah, and yes. Okay. Oh, more than willing. That's, like I said, I made up an ally.
Yeah, I was kind of reading upside down.
I arrived in Vietnam in September 1966. I sat down in Da Nang, and my orders only say that I was assigned to Marine Air Group 16.
Okay.
And after that, they lose track of you. There's nothing to say where I was or what I did.
Wow.
I mean, that Vietnam was crude mm-hmm. back at that time. And 1967 was important because that was the run-up to the 68 Tet Offensive in Way City and down in Vietnam, South Vietnam altogether. But Way City was a focal point. Within 30 days, I learned that my existence was going to be from one day to the next,
okay.
at best. The early part of 67, during the monsoons and still attached to Marine Air Group 16, I was assigned to Phu Bai, that's only 7 or 8 miles below Way City.
Okay.
And Way City is only 40 or 50 miles below the DMZ. So, and we were supporting operations in Dong Ha and in Khe San.
Okay.
The siege at Khe San was hard duty.
Yeah.
I mean, when the C-130s or C-123s rolled into Khe San, they would land, mm-hmm. they would turn around, and they would just push pallets off and take off again.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that's how bad the fire was up there. And they were fighting, I believe, North Vietnamese regulars.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like you were fighting the Viet Cong. And after the monsoons cleared, the enemy activity increased in the run-up to the 68 Tet, like I mentioned. Okay, I wrote up my experiences for my caregiver. She says, can you tell me what you did in Vietnam? I said, okay.
Yeah.
And I wrote up my experiences. They were 10 pages of incidents.
Wow.
Some occurred several times a week, but I mentioned them only once. I mean, you, mm-hmm. you can't put everything down. And then some of them were like biweekly or something like that. We used to, I'll get into one of them in a little bit. The clearest demonstration of what Vietnam was like when I was there is best presented in deaths. But to do that point, you have to have a reference. In Afghanistan, which is war still going on for 16 years.
Right.
They have had a total of 2,386 deaths. 1,834 were to hostile action. That may have changed since these numbers came out. That happens.
Right.
Okay? Yeah. Okay. Any loss of life is tragic in war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not a good thing anywhere you look at it.
Right.
As far as deaths, I had some friends, and this is how I gauged my experience in Vietnam. Richard Lee Walker was from my hometown. We grew up together. He joined the Marine Corps just slightly before I did. I was in Vietnam at Phu Bai over at the airfield.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a little airfield. It was only prop and helicopter aircraft. That's all we had. Excuse me. Dickie, he was mounting up to go on operation. He happened to be at air freight when I was there. And I looked over and I said, Dickie, Larry, you know.
Right.
And we talked and he said, look, when I come back, we'll, you know, get together. I said, okay. So he mounted up and he took off. I don't know how many weeks later, it wasn't many. I got a letter from my mother. Dickie was killed up in Quang Tri province, which is right around the Khe San area. And that was on June 27, 1967. Another death was Terry Lee Ecker. Terry was attached to Marine Air Group 16, and he and an insane bed bug had a lot in common.
Yeah.
He was one of those kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
Wife, two kids, pulled back down to Marble Mountain from Fubai, and he was getting ready to go home. He couldn't have been more than 4 weeks and probably less from going home. He was killed in a rocket attack on Marble Mountain. On August 28, 1967. Now, Dickie was killed on June 27, 1967. Terry was killed on August 28, 1967.
Right.
Okay. Sixth counting day of death, it was 63 days.
Mm-hmm.
Using the Vietnam Wall, because all the names on the wall are listed in order of reported death. So you have to know who you're looking for, and then they can tell you the panel that they're on and the line.
Mm-hmm.
Between Dickie and Terry's death, over 1,700 soldiers were killed in action in 63 days. It was a run-up to the Tet, and things were not pretty.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you can say about it. Excuse me, I was reading Bruce Springsteen's book, and I picked it up, started reading. I had to put it back down again.
Yeah.
I mean, just there's so much there, but there's some things that go into Vietnam. Bruce Springsteen and a guy named Bart Haynes were members of the same band, the Castiles.
Okay.
And they were in northern New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Bart Haynes joined the Marine Corps and was killed also in Quang Tri Province on October 22nd, 1967. Again, using the wall, I counted, I did a quick count just to get a close idea of how many people died.
Right.
Over 1,600 more soldiers died between Terry and Bart Haynes.
Mm-hmm.
That means in less than 120 days, we lost over 3,000 soldiers. Back well over 3,000.
Right, that's a lot.
And if you, the panels of the wall,
mm-hmm.
all you have to do, if you ever get to see the wall, you should. But Dickie was on panel 22 East. Terry is on panel 25 East. There's over 500 names a panel. Over.
Wow.
And then to Bart, Bart Haynes was on panel 28 East. In other words, there's a good reason why I'm a bubble and a half off a plum.
Right. I mean, that, yeah, that's a lot to just take in, even as, you know, someone that wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, you know, while you were over there in Vietnam, you know, did it feel like that? Like you, when you go back and look at the numbers, was it a little bit unbelievable or?
Yeah, the numbers are unbelievable because now I have empirical evidence.
Right.
I knew what I was feeling,
mm-hmm.
and I realized how it affected me.
And kind of, you know, all this information that you have and obviously is a part of your life every day.
It is. You never escape it.
Right. And you said that, is this something that you, you know, haven't really talked to your family about?
They know about it.
Okay.
And, you know, they know that I went through a very rough time in Vietnam. And again, my youngest said, we're just happy that you didn't give that to us.
Right.
And I made a conscious decision not to do that.
Okay.
I also made another conscious decision to become a willing participant in psychotherapy.
Right.
In other words, I know I've got to do something to try and get at least a little bit better anyway, even though I'm not going to be cured. I got to try.
I gotcha. You talked about your experience. Sorry, maybe you talk a little bit more about your experience visiting the Vietnam Wall.
Oh, my God.
Did that have an impact on you?
Big. I tried to call the wife. I said, well, this isn't too bad. And I called her. I was a blubbering idiot. I mean,
It's understandable.
Yeah.
Have you just visited the wall once, or have you been?
I went just visited it once.
Okay.
And my youngest, again, so he was down in, I think he was in North Carolina. He said, Dad, you should have called me. I should have been there with you.
Right.
I didn't do it. Well, it was a last-minute thing to go down anyway. I happened to be close by in some schooling, and I just said, I'm going to go down and see this thing.
That's great. I guess, is there other things on your time or your outline that you had?
How are we doing on time?
Oh, we're good.
Yeah, we're way good, yeah. One of the things I did was fuel runs.
Okay.
And this happened in Fubai. Being in motor transport, hang on a minute, I'm going to get you.
Sure.
We have pictures.
Very organized here, I like that.
This was a truck. It was a straight truck carrying jet fuel.
Okay.
We used to get in a truck, and there was a driver, and I was riding shotgun. Again, there was a lot of things we did.
Right.
We would leave the base at Fubai, which is a big compound. Mm-hmm. Third Marines were across the road from us, and, of course, there's Marine Air Wing Force Logistics and all that, and then there was an Arvin boot camp right outside to the north. We would leave Fubai, run to Way City, catch a road paralleling a river, and go out to a place called Tam Mai.
Okay.
The runs were lone unit. No convoy support, no air support, no communications. I used to joke, if you miss seeing a fireball go up in the sky, you miss watching me die.
Oh, wow.
But that's a picture of one of the trucks.
And so it was just the trucks, just you going there. You didn't have
lone unit runs.
Wow.
And it was all VC country in between.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize how VC it was until an operation got mounted up, and all these people that were in the rice paddies, they were gone.
Wow.
And then when the operation was over, they all swarmed back.
Mm-hmm. Very, very cool. And so what was your job specifically?
I was supposed to be a truck mechanic, but I did a whole bunch of other things.
Okay. What are some of the other things that you did?
Just this and that. it was more this and that than anything else. I was trying to get parts to keep our trucks running.
Mm-hmm.
And we you couldn't get all the parts you needed because a lot of the parts, or these trucks, some of them broke down quite a bit.
Really?
Yeah, we had a forward control Jeep that had I wouldn't even use that engine in a tractor. I mean, it was terrible. And they were down all the time. And it wasn't a Jeep engine that was in it. It was something called a Surless. It was a 3-cylinder, 2-cycle diesel loop scavenge engine.
Mm-hmm.
Who would invent something like that?
Right.
Only the Marine Corps would buy them. My God, they were terrible. Wow. You couldn't keep them running. Everything else, the running gear, transmissions, and all that, they were good.
Mm-hmm.
And you could tell when that diesel engine started getting to the cab area because there would be a crack from the back of a vent in the back of the cab all the way up to the window.
Oh, wow.
It would, from vibration.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I'm assuming, were you a mechanic before you went into military, or did they have to train?
Yeah, I had been working in my dad's gas station, I said, and if you joined, back then there was no lottery. You were gone within 2 weeks of your 18th birthday.
Right.
So if you wanted any kind of control over what you were going to do and what you were going to be assigned, you had to join, but it was with a gun to your head, because you're going to go.
Right. So your work that you did, you were a mechanic. Would you like to talk a little bit about what you guys did, like when you weren't working? Did you ever have free time while you were over there?
You had a normal type work day.
Okay.
Because you're in this compound. But once it's over with, there really wasn't anything. I mean, there was the E-Club, which is the enlisted man's club.
Right.
And that's nothing but beer. I mean, you know. So
how did you guys keep yourselves occupied in, like, the evenings?
Beer.
That's a good way to be occupied.
I thought it was anyway.
Gotcha.
Now, you don't have any entertainment. You're in a compound and you are in there.
Gotcha.
But then things happen. One night we were sitting there, and this is one I don't even have on my outline here. We were sitting down, and me and Smitty are sitting there, and I'm looking up and saying, and we see a light coming down. We know it's an aircraft, but we can't hear anything.
Right.
And if you listen for the sound of the aircraft, you'll know what it is. Mm-hmm. And he says, you know, I don't hear anything. I said, neither do I. He says, what do you think it is? It could be a caribou. I don't know. It was a plane that was as big as this building. It could land in a space of the size of this table.
Wow.
It wasn't quite as, wingspan and everything.
Right, right.
But it sat down, and it went by us. And I said, Smitty, that's a jet. He says, this place isn't long enough to land a jet. And I looked down the runway, and I said, well, I know that, and you know that, but I'm not real certain he understands that.
Oh, wow. So did it land?
It was a controlled emergency landing. They ran out of fuel.
Oh, okay.
We found this out later. Mm-hmm. We went down. Smitty said, oh, to heck with it. Let's go see what's going on. So we jumped in a vehicle and right down in the middle of the runway. Thankfully, they stopped air traffic. Mm-hmm. We got down to where the jet was, and we're 50, maybe 75 feet away from it.
Right.
And these pilots have already dismounted the aircraft. They ran off in pea gravel, which is designed to stop them. Mm-hmm. And they don't keep going. And they got out, and all of a sudden they became animated and started running at us. And I'm going, I went, put up my fingers, and they went right by me.
Huh.
And Smitty said, excuse me, gentlemen, would you like to get out of here? We have a vehicle. He says, yeah, we would. Got in the vehicle, and we started down the middle of the runway again. And Smitty, ever being the diplomat, says, you know, you guys were getting away from that plane pretty fast. Was there something we should know about? He says, yeah, there's a 500-pound bomb under the right wing of that aircraft.
Oh.
And we thought we lost it over North Vietnam.
But it was still on the plane?
It was still on the plane.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I would be driving away pretty fast, too.
So, and there's more to that, but I have been able, thankfully, mm-hmm. and it's all defense mechanism, to talk about my Vietnam experiences and put a comedic edge to it.
Right.
But it's all defense mechanism for me.
Right. But it is great that you're able to share the stories, though. I mean,
I wrote them up. I wrote them up for the boys. My dad served in World War II, and I don't know anything about the context of his service or the texture.
Right.
What was war like for him? He was well behind the lines, thankfully. So he never had to deal with PTSD. Mm-hmm. Never had to deal with it, which is a great thing.
Right.
Because he raised my brother and I differently.
Right.
So.
Well, are there any other stories that you had that you would like to share today from your time there? Or anything, you know, that you'd like to share with the public or with your family?
Let's go with one more.
Sure.
I was doing my most favorite job in Vietnam, mm-hmm. operating a forklift offloading pallets of beer for the E-Club.
That would be a fun job.
And, you know, there were explosions. There was an explosion. Boom. No. EOD, I guess, you know, mm-hmm. getting rid of something. Boom. Another one. And then another explosion. And another one after that. And one of the guys that I knew came up and said, get your stuff and get to the line. Mm-hmm. The ammunition dump, 3rd Marines ammunition dump, is on fire.
Wow.
This is during the summer of 1967.
Okay.
And we got out to the line, and there was a warrant officer. This guy was supposed to be a meteorologist, but he was more like a closet grunt, a closet infantryman.
Really?
Yeah. And he, great guy, had a lot of leadership about him. I mean, if he said, I want to go to Hanoi and free prisoners, I'd have gone with him. Because
okay.
I figured I'd have a good chance of getting back alive. He was that good.
Right.
He exuded that much leadership. Anyway, we've got 1,000 times the 4th of July over here with lethal ordnance going off. And I mean, it went off for hours. His name was Gunner Walker. Gunner Walker, he was going to address us. So we got all called together, and he always smoked a cigarette and always pointed the cigarette down. It was just his way of doing things. And he came up, took a puff off his cigarette, and said, "Gentlemen, the 3rd Marine Ammunition Dump is on fire, and we have no resupply. However, if Charlie's got his stuff together, stuff being this, we're going to have a ground attack tonight. So we have to prepare for it." He takes a puff off his cigarette. He says, "There's an outer perimeter that's already set up. We will be the interior line." Take another puff off his cigarette. And then he says, "If you hear a burst of automatic carbine fire," which is what he, his weapon of choice. "So if you hear that, shoot in that direction right there." He took another puff off his cigarette and said, "You gentlemen have a good evening."
Oh, wow.
And still a thousand times the 4th of July is going off behind us. I mean, less than a mile away.
Wow. So what did you guys do? I mean,
set up for a ground attack.
Wow.
And I was going to wait for that burst of automatic carbine fire before I did anything.
Right. Did it happen?
No.
Okay.
There wasn't. Charlie didn't have his stuff together enough to do anything like that.
Cool.
Do you have any questions?
The only other one I kind of...
Here. Let me get that.
Just kind of my stuff here. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like when you came home from Vietnam? Where was your hometown at?
It was on the East Coast.
Okay.
And when I got back, of course, I'm dealing with mental issues now.
Right.
And I didn't know it. The trouble with PTSD is you don't know it. Nobody else knows about it. And even if they did, they wouldn't know how to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult.
Right.
So, you know, that when I got back, it was, okay, I'm free of the Marine Corps. They wanted you to ship over. Literally, if you shipped over, in other words, re-enlisted in the Marine Corps for 6 years,
right,
you had enough to buy yourself a 1967 Chevelle 396 four-speed loaded out.
Yeah. Was that good at the time? I know now, I mean, my husband's a car guy, and that's a good car.
Yeah. It is quite a car. And the thing of it is that you can come back and buy it and still have money left over, but you might not live to come back and enjoy it.
Right.
And that's that. I'd already been through enough of Vietnam, and I like being alive.
Right.
I was not going to, I wasn't going to ship over. That wasn't going to happen.
Gotcha.
In fact, it was pretty bad back then when people were trying to get, you know, you had to go in and see a shipping over sergeant, then you had to go see the CO to see about, and they're all trying to talk you into staying in. And they were actually keeping a tally somewhere of how soon or how little time they spent in the CO's office before they got kicked out.
Wow.
I mean, there was one guy, his name was Sergeant Brown. He looked like a model lifer. Had a belly on him, high and tight haircut, rosy cheeks up here. I mean, he's a model. It looked like he could walk around with coffee cups for the rest of his life.
Right.
Anyway, my understanding is that he got kicked out of the CO's office in 18 seconds on a shipping over lecture.
Wow. Pretty fast.
Very fast. Mm-hmm. Very fast.
You talked about, you know, some of the people you knew while you were over serving.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still stay in touch with any of
them? I've lost contact with all of them. When I left, I was happy to leave, and I didn't want any more to do with it. Mm-hmm. And it's not that the people were bad. It's just I was done.
Yeah. Okay. And then are you a part of any other military groups? I know you're part of the VA. Are there any other groups?
I'm a member of the Veterans of Foreign Wars and the Vietnam Veterans of America.
Okay.
I joined both organizations, and I get the, you know, magazines and newsletters and all that kind of thing. And and donation requests.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of those.
I understand that. Well, was there anything else you wanted to add or talk about?
Yeah.
Okay.
PTSD. Mm-hmm. Do not underestimate it. And anybody who's been to war, it can happen. It can happen easier than you think. And if you get PTSD there, you're going to have trouble in a lot of areas. You need help. And mental illness is something, and it is a mental illness. It's a mental condition. Mm-hmm. You can feel alone, as though you're the only one that has it. And I have talked to other war veterans, and when they say, I'm having this, that, or I think I've got PTSD. I said, well, you probably do have it. If you want to talk to somebody, I give them my phone number.
That's great.
I know, if I know them and I can trust them, here's my phone number. You have a problem, you call me. Because I've had PTSD now for over 50 years.
And I'm assuming you didn't probably have someone to call for all those
years. No, there wasn't. There wasn't.
So that's great.
In fact, PTSD didn't get recognized as a mental disorder until the late 70s, I think.
Right.
But yet they knew about this. People were having issues mm-hmm. that have been in danger and combat. And danger alone will give it to you.
Right.
You throw combat in, you're just exacerbating a problem.
Well, thank you for sharing
your
experiences with this. I'm sure there are plenty of people out there that maybe will hear it and hear from your experiences. I do appreciate it, taking the time to come in and talk to us today. So
not a problem. The idea was, my objective, if I help one war veteran who says, wait a minute, I've got some issues too.
Right.
Get into the VA, ask for a PTSD evaluation. Get an evaluation.
Yeah. Well, that is great advice.
Just get help. Get help. And remember, going back to the quote, taking care of myself doesn't mean me first. It means me too.
Right, because you've got not just you, but your family.
Yeah, your loved ones can help a lot. But remember, they may not know what's going on, and you may not fully know what's going on.
Right.
So getting a little bit of help, really, it really works out well. It can save you a lot of problems.